From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. In October, we celebrate Columbus Day. Or do we? A lot of cities and states are opting out.
Indigenous Peoples Day just really opens up this opportunity for conversations and for visibility that's super important because a lot of the rest of the time we don't think about Native people.
The movement behind Indigenous Peoples Day and a look at one state that made the change. Also on our show, the fears that often get in the way of raising our kids bilingual.
I was also kind of embarrassed talking to my parents just because I felt like I wasn't completely fluent in it. Like, you sit there and you just say, why bother speaking in Spanish when we all speak English? Let's just speak English and it'll be much easier.
All this coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No te vayas. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. For almost a century, the United States has dedicated a day to Italian explorer Christopher Columbus.
In the middle of all the excitement, happy Columbus Day, Scott.
For many, Columbus Day not only commemorates his arrival to the Americas, but it's also a chance for Italian Americans across the country to celebrate their cultural heritage with flags and parades and floats draped in green, white, and red.
This is a great celebration for Italian Americans and Italians and for all of those people who are not Italian who want to be Italian. It's a celebration of our culture, our heritage.
But not everyone is on board with celebrating Columbus. His colonization of the New World led to the bloodshed of indigenous people. And while he did arrive to the Americas, he never even set foot in North America. He arrived in the Caribbean. So in the United States, many people are looking to make a change.
Voted to replace Columbus Day.
Celebrate the history and contributions of indigenous cultures.
Columbus Day is officially history in the city of Cincinnati, at least for this year.
For the past three decades, cities and states are opting out of celebrating Columbus Day and instead are choosing to commemorate the original inhabitants of the Americas, indigenous people. Joining me in the studio is producer Janice Yamoka. Hey, Janice.
Hey, Maria.
So, Janice, you've been interested in looking at the movement for Indigenous Peoples Day for a while, really.
Yeah, and I've actually seen more and more places make this change. So I wanted to look at the history of Columbus Day and how Indigenous Peoples Day got its start.
Right. So I've heard a lot about this from a long time ago because in Mexico, we don't celebrate Columbus Day. It's actually Día de la Raza. So I've thought about reframing this particular holiday on multiple occasions, but it's actually happening now.
Yeah. And I think these conversations are happening a lot, especially with Indigenous youth really reclaiming their roots and understanding where their ancestors came from.
So it's a well-known fact that Christopher Columbus, in fact, never set foot in North America.
Let me break it down for those of you who may not have gotten that history like some of us did. In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue.
In 1492,
you probably have heard this rhyme. It was a poem used as a teaching tool in most U.S. schools.
Columbus sailed the ocean blue.
Christopher Columbus had this wild idea that he could navigate across the ocean to find an alternative route to Asia, to find spices to bring back to Europe. Because guess what? The world was round, so clearly he would make it there eventually. And the story about Columbus, we didn't just learn about it at school. It was in movies and all over pop culture.
God go with you, Don Cristobal Colón.
I believe you will find the Indies.
So, in 1492, he takes three ships and sails across the big, wide ocean, attempting to reach Asia. And they make it to the Caribbean. This is where his history gets tricky, because he basically wipes out almost the entire indigenous population.
Columbus's voyages to the Caribbean decimated indigenous populations in that era, murdering whole communities, enslaving Native women, Native children, Native men.
That's Elizabeth Ellis. She's an assistant professor of history and teaches early American and Native American history at New York University. And despite this bloody history, there are still monuments dedicated to him. Today, in the Dominican Republic, one of the places where Columbus landed, it's claimed that his remains are still there in an extravagant monument in the shape of a cross built for the 500th anniversary of his voyage. But even there, his legacy is debated.
Which leads me to my question. How does Christopher Columbus end up getting a holiday named after him in the United States?
Before we dive into this, as we all know, Columbus Day is one of 10 official federal holidays, like Thanksgiving and Christmas Day, which means that federal workers get the day off. And Columbus Day is also one of the few holidays that honors an individual, just like another individual you might know.
President Reagan signed
Martin Luther King Jr.
today, creating a national holiday honoring Martin Luther King.
What's unique about the holiday is that it's also a day where Italian Americans proudly celebrate their culture. Actually, one of the biggest Columbus Day parades is right here in New York City. Last year, over 35,000 people participated. And to understand why this is such an important holiday for Italian heritage, we have to go back to the late 1800s.
Between like the 1880s and the 1920s, when there's this huge wave of Italian immigration to the U.S., Italian immigrants are facing really serious discrimination. I mean, by and large, people are working low-income jobs. They're treated as outsiders. People are freaked out by the fact that they're not speaking English.
And because many were Catholic, they also faced religious discrimination.
I mean, people are really suffering. And so in the midst of this climate, there's a big push from within the Italian American community to think about how can we revise this? How can we fix what our people are going through?
At this time, Columbus was already a celebrated explorer. And this was in large part due to author Washington Irving. If you've heard of him, it's because he wrote the Halloween favorite, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow.
As the story goes, Ichabod Crane fled across the bridge to the old Dutch church, racing to escape the headless horseman close behind.
In the 1820s, he writes this sort of glorified, very romanticized account of Columbus, and that work becomes very instrumental in framing Columbus as kind of a pioneer explorer.
So the Italian-American community embraced Columbus. After all, he was Italian, Catholic, and a hero.
There's a Colorado newspaper owner, Angelo Noce, who's out in Colorado, and he's observing the really dismal conditions of Italian immigrants and laborers on the railroads and in mines. And he starts lobbying for recognition of Italian contributions to America by turning to Christopher Columbus's legacy.
In 1907, Colorado becomes the first state in the U.S. to officially observe Columbus Day. This started a push to make it a national holiday. And in 1937, Columbus Day became a federal holiday. And ongoing celebrations of Italian heritage were finally validated.
If we think about it, what are the other days that we celebrate Italian Americans, right? There's an absence, and so there's a need to, in the way that many immigrant communities who have suffered discrimination, there's a pride there at Italian and American heritage.
So Columbus Day in the United States becomes this day of celebration for generations of Italians and Italian Americans. So what's changed?
In the 60s and 70s, indigenous people were involved in the civil rights movement. It was known as the Red Power Movement. The goal was to make indigenous rights part of the political conversation. And to challenge what students are being taught. In this clip from 1970, indigenous activist and professor Lyman L. Brightman addresses just that.
What they teach in this country is European history under the guise of American history, because you don't find a damn thing about Indians in your history books.
There's a real push to change education and to change the perception, the way we talk about American Indian people, right? Because Native knowledge, Native history, Native perspectives had been so devalued within the academy.
Aside from teaching and knowing this history, Elizabeth is also a citizen of the Peoria tribe of Indians of Oklahoma. Historians also started to break down the myth of the celebrated explorer.
Columbus's voyage left a series of diaries and documents of that account, and it doesn't take much to kind of go back to those original encounters and find where Columbus and his men are talking about showing up in Caribbean islands, capturing and enslaving Native people to make them labor and to destroy by conquest the Native civilizations that were there in looking for gold.
All of that led to a major change in South Dakota. In the late 80s, a local indigenous-owned newspaper, originally called the Lakota Times, advocated to get rid of Columbus Day. And in 1990, South Dakota, a state with a large Native population, became the first state to officially replace Columbus Day with Native Americans Day.
So while the rest of the nation celebrates Columbus Day and pays tribute to the past, we are forging new paths in the history of the state of South Dakota with the celebration of the very first Native American Day in South Dakota.
Cities would soon follow. And in 1992, on the 500th anniversary of Columbus's voyage, Berkeley, California declared that it would no longer celebrate Columbus Day.
Native Americans are protesting, saying that his arrival led to millions of Native deaths. So sensitive, politically correct Berkeley, California has renamed Columbus Day Indigenous Peoples Day.
And even though both South Dakota and the city of Berkeley celebrated Native people, there was a reason for using the term Indigenous.
Framing it as Indigenous instead of Native American Day is also really important because we recognize that at this point, in addition to Italian American, Irish American, all kinds of other immigrant populations, we have a lot of Indigenous migrant populations within the Americas as well.
And then, one by one, states made the change to celebrate Indigenous people over celebrating Columbus.
New Mexico became the fifth state in the U.S. to replace Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day.
Formerly known as Columbus Day here in Alaska.
Vermont has hopped on board on Thursday.
Then cities followed.
The L.A. City Council has voted to replace Columbus
Day. St. Paul and Minneapolis have decided.
In the city of Cincinnati.
For a lot of Native people, so much of the call for justice begins with education, so that we are asking, we understand the legacies of the American state, we understand what Native people are going through today, and we can begin to tie these in meaningful ways. Indigenous Peoples Day just really opens up this opportunity for conversations and for visibility. It's super important because a lot of the rest of the time we don't think about Native people, you know, unless you're Native the rest of the days of the year.
Right now, seven states and over 130 cities have dropped Columbus Day to celebrate Indigenous people. For some cities, the change has been in the works for years. So I was curious, what were the conversations about this topic in the state with the largest white population in the country?
Welcome aboard Concord Coach Lines. My name is Rick.
So I hopped on a bus and took a little six-hour ride up the East Coast.
Coming up on Latino USA, producer Janice Yamoka heads to a state that has recently made the change. Stay with us, no te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the William T. Grant Foundation, working to harness the power of research to make a difference in the lives of children, teens, and young adults for more than 80 years. Learn more at wtgrantfdn.org. And the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland and Northeast Ohio more globally competitive, livable, sustainable, and just. More information available at gundfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And when we left off, we mentioned that several states have made the change from Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day.
Yeah, but the real debates and conversations are happening in the cities, at the city council meetings. They're usually part of the first steps into making statewide changes. So I wanted to hear what the locals had to say.
Yeah, in fact, you decided to jump on a bus and get to Maine. So Janice, take it from here.
We're now arriving at the Portland terminal, so please take a good look around. Make sure you have everything. Don't forget to check.
I arrived in Portland, Maine's largest city. And the next morning, I drove a few hours north to Indian Island. Indian Island is a reservation where the citizens of the Penobscot Nation live. The island is small, with a population of just over 600. And the Penobscot River shimmers and flows around it. I drive over a bridge that connects me to a few main roads on the island.
Hi, can I help you?
Yeah, I'm looking for Molly and Dana.
Molly and Dana? Yes.
Molly and Dana is the tribal ambassador for the Penobscot Nation.
Hi, thank you.
I met her in her office.
Hi. Janice, yeah, nice thank you for you. Meeting me.
No problem.
Tribal ambassador, what does your role consist of?
When the House is in session or the legislature is in session, I'm there quite a bit, testifying committees, helping to write bills, going to the sessions, the caucuses, and kind of talking to lawmakers. Don't call me a lobbyist. Whenever I give that description, people say, oh, you're a lobbyist, but it's a lot more than that. It's the sovereign tribal presence in the state house.
Maine is not the most diverse place. It's about 95% white. But the state has four federally recognized indigenous nations. The Passamaquoddy tribe, the Houlton Band of Maliseet Indians, the Rustic Band of Mi'kmaqs, and the Penobscot Nation. And historically, these nations have not had a good relationship with the state government because of issues over land rights and sovereignty. Despite the lack of diversity, Mollyann grew up on Indian Island, surrounded by family. And she even went to school there. Her father was a culture teacher when she was a child, and she learned how to make baskets.
We learned how to make shelters in the woods and build fires, different arts and crafts. And then there was kind of a component of social awareness about what it means to be Indigenous in the world today.
But everything changed when she started high school in a city off the reservation, where she said she was one of five Indigenous students there.
So the jump from kind of being in my little reservation community into a large school where I didn't know anybody and I was often on the opposite side of every single issue from my classmates.
Like stereotypical mascots. One day, she watched the basketball game on television, a high school basketball game. And both teams had native mascots.
One was the Warriors, but they used kind of Indian imagery. And the other school was named the Indians, their mascot. And they had feathers and war paint, and they were doing like the chanting and dancing and stuff. And I was watching it with my dad, and I said, you know, what the hell is this all about? I said, is this what people think we do? Is this how people, you know, think we act?
She started to travel as a peer educator to different schools in Maine that had Indigenous mascots.
And I walked into one school that used the Redskins as their mascot. And just about the whole student body was in the gymnasium. I was on a panel with some other people. And they all had their jerseys on, and they booed when we all walked in. So when you're like 16 years old or so, and you're already kind of insecure and forming your place in the world, it's extremely jarring.
Around the same time, her dad, Barry Dana, who was her former culture teacher as a kid, became the chief of the Penobscot Nation.
And that was a very formative time for me. It was kind of when I was in high school, starting to speak out about things. And he's had this drive to have Indigenous Peoples Day for a long time.
So Mollyann teamed up with her dad and reached out to different communities. In 2015, Belfast became the first city in Maine to replace Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day. One by one, Mollyann went to meetings to give her testimony.
I want to thank my kids for being out on a school night, so I'll keep it brief. I'm not sure of all the testimony you've heard tonight, but I can tell you a little bit about my experience as an Indigenous woman in Maine.
Almost like a small tour, going from city to city.
I ran myself ragged for a little while, getting all these meetings, but it is important because when you talk to people on a human level, saying this causes us pain, and it's not just our feelings getting hurt. There's real systemic things going on, and it's not just the name of a holiday. It's so much larger, and you can help us on our way to healing by making these changes. That's when I saw kind of lights go off.
But in 2017, it was in Portland, Maine's largest city, where she found much more resistance. The city gathered for a council meeting on a Monday evening.
The clerk, please read Resolve 3.
Resolve 3, resolution recognizing Indigenous Peoples Day on the second Monday in October, sponsored by Councilor Pius Ali.
And each of the residents who were there were impassioned by this topic, including Mollyann.
It's a very simple ask. You know, we can acknowledge history, we can commemorate it, we can see Columbus as a flawed historical figure that made contributions, but also made very atrocious and heinous crimes against humanity. That's the reality. And you can't ask Indigenous people to gloss over that reality so that everyone can have a day off from work.
Some of the residents had speeches prepared, and some jumped up to share their thoughts last minute.
We believe that Indigenous people of the New World deserve their own day. They deserve a national day of their own. But we shouldn't deny the role this seafarer from Genoa had in the eventual shaping of America. We propose that we celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day on a separate day from Columbus Day.
Jim, your time is up. Do you need additional
time? We must never obliterate the spirit of Columbus from historical memory.
Each resident had 3 minutes at the podium. The commentaries went on for over an hour.
Yes, it is true that the Native Americans endured many atrocities in the past, and these actions should be rectified, but not at the expense of celebrating our Italian ancestors who faced discrimination for centuries. We as Italian Americans are very proud of our heritage. Portland has a large population of Italians.
Like most of the country, much of the pushback to not change this holiday comes from the Italian community. And many of those who spoke in Portland were members of the local Italian Heritage Center. I paid a visit, and Carmela Rialli was the first person to greet me.
Good morning.
Hi, I'm Janice. I'm a producer with Latino State. Nice to meet you. Are you the president of Italian Heritage?
She's the current president of the Italian Heritage Center, and her family's been in Maine since her grandparents arrived from Italy decades ago.
My daughter, Celeste, who's very into her heritage, she was Little Miss Columbus Day. Besides the parade, we had all kinds of Italian food. It was just a big hoop to do, and we never even really talked about Columbus.
For Carmela, the celebration is about Italian heritage and not about Columbus.
It was just Columbus Day.
And she talked more about it at the city council meeting in Portland. But she emphasized that her Italian history would be lost.
Increasingly, political correctness, multicultural education, and governments are attempting and succeeding to steer and erase history. If we as children of immigrants do not stop and speak up as we are doing today, where does this stop? Independence Day, Christmas Day, St. Patrick's Day, or even Thanksgiving will fall victim to a body of people who want an even palate.
Mollyann, the Penobscot Nation tribal ambassador we heard from earlier, spoke after Carmela that day.
If we want to talk about rewriting history, we need to start with the holiday Columbus Day, because he never actually stepped foot here. It's a falsehood that Columbus discovered America. He never entered North America, and he didn't discover anything because there were already people here.
I told Carmela that even though she doesn't celebrate Columbus on Columbus Day, he's still the subject of this whole debate.
And I'm sure there's good people and bad people in every culture. And you know, I don't know if it's true what they're saying about Columbus, but I'm sure in every culture, someone has done that. So for all these years, why didn't someone come forward years and years ago? And why is it just now? We still celebrate it here. So
But even if she's just celebrating her culture on Columbus Day, she's still, in a way, ultimately celebrating the person it's named after. Here's Molly Ann again.
I am all for Italian Americans celebrating their heritage, but I would just think there's got to be a better way to celebrate Italian heritage than to celebrate kind of a genocidal maniac.
After an hour of testimonies from residents and council members, the council put the proposal to a vote.
Will the clerk please call the roll? Oh, it's hand vote, sorry. All those in favor, please signify by raising your hand. Any opposed?
The council members raised their right hands and voted unanimously.
It is unanimous.
To declare the change from Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day in September of 2017 in the city of Portland. And the movement didn't stop there. At the beginning of this year, the House and the Senate passed the bill. And in April, the Maine governor, Janet Mills, signed it into state law.
I believe we're stronger when we lift up the voices of those who have been harmed and marginalized in the past. Because there is power in a name and in who we choose to honor.
Surrounded by the chiefs of Maine's four tribes, Mills signed the law to replace Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day.
All right, Janice, so Maine is actually one of the latest states to drop Columbus Day officially. But it is evident that even after a law has been passed and it becomes kind of official, a lot of people are still divided.
Yeah, and it's more than just the residents. The day I was there, October 1st, Nick Isgro, the mayor of a city called Waterville in Maine, issued a mayoral proclamation, which he read that night at a city council meeting.
We'll hereby proclaim October 14th, 2019 to be Columbus Day, and I urge all of Waterville's residents to celebrate this day with appropriate ceremonies and remembrances.
Wow, is all I can say. I mean, it just feels, I guess I feel a little bit sad that the mayor feels that Christopher Columbus has got to be so adored in this moment. And it's not that he's being attacked, it's that people are saying there's another story that needs to be looked at.
Yeah, and most of the residents at that meeting were not happy. But I guess this goes to show that people are always trying to resist change.
And I guess one of the things that we can take away from this is that, you know, names really are important. And it's also never too late to make a symbolic change.
And we don't have to erase the complicated history of this country. But we should be aware of who and who we aren't celebrating. Here's Molly Ann.
And when you really boil it down, it's basically the whole country celebrating not only a lie, because Columbus did not discover the Americas, they're also celebrating this idea that Europeans had to come over and make this place better and improve it and wipe out the people that were here. And that's a lot to chew on, I think, for any Indigenous person, that these people are taking a day off from work to reflect on the fact that they wish you weren't here and that your people didn't live through all of this.
Thank you to Janice Yamoka for reporting that story. A month after Maine replaced Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day, Maine became the first state in the country to ban Native American mascots in public schools and colleges. Molly Ann Dana, tribal ambassador to the Penobscot Nation, was a part of that effort. There are currently seven states and over 130 cities that have decided to drop Columbus Day and instead dedicate the day to Indigenous people. But still, in the United States, Columbus Day remains a federal holiday. Last year, we did a story about the decisions we make as parents to speak Spanish to our children. We're going to revisit that conversation now. So I'm here in the studio with producer and new mom, Ginny Montalvo.
Hey, Maria.
So, Ginny, you just had a baby boy, Martin.
Yes, and Maria, we talked a ton about having kids.
Yeah.
When I was pregnant.
Yes.
Or when I wasn't pregnant.
No, I
Or little
know.
Did we know that I was pregnant.
Then next week you were like, I'm pregnant.
JK. And now he's 7 months and
oh
it's flown by.
Love it. I love it.
And he's doing a lot of ba 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 ba. So what language are you speaking to him in?
We are speaking Spanish.
100%.
100%. Immersion, all Spanish, all the time.
My son, that's what we did with Raul. Mm-hmm. It was monolingual Spanish, 100% all the time.
I have this conversation a lot with my husband, Ernesto. He's from Peru, and he was terrified that raising our son here in the U.S. meant that he wasn't going to speak perfect Spanish.
And then they're going to go back to the home country, and then they're going to be teased and made fun of, and then they're not going to want to speak Spanish.
And that is exactly what happened to my brother. He was that kid who said, I don't want to speak Spanish. My parents are from the Dominican Republic. For the most part, we spoke Spanish at home growing up, as you can hear in these adorable home recordings from my childhood. But my brother and I pretty much always speak in English, and have since we were kids. We lived in small towns between Georgia and Alabama, so it wasn't like there was other kids or even adults for him to speak Spanish to in the early 90s. But Maria, like your son, I learned Spanish first.
Wow, that is so cute. That's you.
That's little Jeannie.
Wow.
My mom used to sing to me in Spanish. And she used to read books in Spanish. So I speak Spanish at home with Ernesto and little Martin. But now that I'm a parent myself, it kind of got me to thinking about the decisions that my own parents made in terms of language for me and my younger brother. So I wanted to figure out, why was it that I learned Spanish at home and my brother didn't?
So my name is Carlos Montalvo. Yeah, I like long walks on the beach, sunsets.
That is my brother, or as I like to call him, Nerdo. He is literally a rocket scientist.
Oh my God, what?
I'm a mechanical engineering professor at the University of South Alabama. I got my bachelor's, master's, and PhD in aerospace engineering at the Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta.
He's literally a genius.
I have a brother like that. Doesn't speak perfect Spanish, by the way.
And neither does Carlos.
There were two reasons why I didn't want to speak Spanish. One, it was hard for me. I didn't have the necessary vocabulary to talk to my parents in a way that I felt I could explain my ideas correctly. Since it wasn't my first language, it was tough for me to generate sentences to reply back.
So I get it, right? We all feel embarrassment when we're uncomfortable with a language. But for my brother, it seemed to go deeper.
You don't want people to think that you're stupid and laugh at you, you know? You sit there and you just say, why bother speaking in Spanish when we all speak English? Let's just speak English and it'll be much easier.
We both lived in the same house. We both grew up with the same parents. I speak Spanish since I was a baby and Carlos didn't. So how does that work? How does that happen? Mami.
Sí.
¿Y está grabando? Míralo bien.
Está grabando ahora mismo. Vamos a cambiar a inglés.
Okay.
Okay.
I talked to Carlos last week.
Yes.
I asked my mom if there was a conscious decision to switch to English when my brother was little. I didn't really remember that being an actual decision.
We did change to English, but the situation happened that the preschool or kindergarten teacher, when he was learning English, she said that he was having a harder time. So the situation wasn't that it was our decision. The decision was kind of made for us.
When Carlos was born, we lived in a tiny town in Alabama. We were the only Latino family there. And after that, we moved to a suburb of Atlanta. It was not the international metropolis it is today.
So the teacher explicitly said to you, don't speak Spanish to him at home because he's getting confused?
She didn't say Spanish per se. She said, don't speak two languages at home.
Wow, so the teacher basically said, you're setting your kid back by raising him bilingually, which, you know, factually we know now is not true. I mean, right, this has totally been disproven.
Correct, and I spoke to an expert about this.
My name is Lisa Bedore. I'm a professor in communication sciences and disorders at the University of Texas at Austin.
I asked Lisa if she'd heard of cases like my brother's,
you know, where a teacher tells the parent it's just better to speak one language.
I think that it's unfortunately a long-term common practice that people do suggest to families that they speak only one language, and that's usually English, to their children to prevent them from becoming confused. There's no real evidence that there's an increased risk for having language learning difficulties just because you're hearing and using two languages. We know that hearing and using two languages offers social and cognitive advantages.
So being bilingual is not related to learning difficulties. The teacher was wrong. Our parents would send us to the Dominican Republic for 6 weeks at a time to be with our grandmother. Like, go, be with your family and speak Spanish.
Were you like, we're going to the Dominican, no vamos? Or was it like, oh my God, we're going to have to speak Spanish?
For me, it was like, oh, I get to go hang out with my cousins and be with family and stuff. And you know, the language was the language and you just spoke it. But for him, I guess it was a little scarier. Then there's the part of speaking Spanish that's kind of cultural, right? Growing up, for me, something just clicked. I started watching telenovelas, I read People in Español, and I got really into Latin music. But my brother was so different.
I mean, I was a metalhead in high school and listened to a bunch of, you know, thrash metal and Metallica and all that.
Maria, it's kind of weird because it sounds like what he's saying is that a thrash metal, Metallica-loving person cannot be Latino. But metal is huge in Latin America. Side note, my husband, who was born and raised in Peru, is actually a big metal fan. But that's another story.
Aside from being like, you know, a metalhead skateboarding teenager, was there anything else that made you be like, I want nothing to do with this culture?
Oh, that was probably just, I was a lazy teenager, probably. I probably just didn't care. I just wanted to hang out with my friends.
So I asked my brother, you know, does he have any regrets about not speaking Spanish more when we were growing up?
Would I have wished something would be different? I don't think so. I mean, mommy and poppy moved to the United States to, you know, to give us a better life. And that's where we grew up. And people speak English here. You know, so I married somebody who only speaks English. And so I think that's just kind of how it is. I mean, at the end of the day, it's just, you're just trying to convey an idea. That's what language is for, right? And so why would you purposely make it harder for yourself?
From my brother's perspective, it's kind of like English is easier. So why am I going to make my life harder by trying to speak Spanish? If I can communicate and I can convey my ideas in English, there's no incentive to speak Spanish.
Well, it seems like he just doesn't put being Latino, Spanish speaker, it seems like that is not like his top three most important things in terms of his how he identifies and sees his life.
Right. I mean, he might not have ever identified really with his Latino side, but now he's older and things change. Both of us have kids and we have to decide how we're going to raise them. I know what my stance is on passing on my language and my heritage to my son. But I don't really know what's in Carlos's head or how he wants to raise his family.
How old are the kids?
Elena is 4 and Luis is almost 2.
Okay, wait a second.
You noticed, didn't you?
Wait, of course. Well, that's the giveaway. Elena?
And Luis. Luis Carlos.
Okay, so I have a hint. I have an idea of what happens.
Do you though?
Dun, dun, dun. Coming up on Latino USA, does Carlos speak Spanish to his kids? Stay with us, no te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Conrad N. Hilton Foundation, working to improve the lives of individuals living in poverty and experiencing disadvantage throughout the world. Learn more at hiltonfoundation.org. And the Zimmel Family Foundation, supporting the National Center for Learning Disabilities, which works to improve the lives of 1 in 5 individuals with learning and attention issues. Learn more at ncld.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and I'm here in the studio with producer Jeannie Montalvo.
Hey, Maria.
All right, so Jeannie, before the break, we were talking about bilingualism and your brother and what his plans are for his own kids.
I mentioned earlier that Carlos didn't really like speaking Spanish when he was a kid, but he actually does speak it now. But before I tell you what my brother decided to do with his kids, let's talk to Lisa Bedore again, our expert, and have her unpack some of the things that go into teaching your child your native language.
I think people think that bilingualism will just happen, and really it takes that kind of ongoing effort to value and you know, keep using your Spanish day after day so that the child understands that it's important.
I asked her about how you can get your kid to become bilingual when you have one parent who just speaks English and another parent that speaks English and Spanish.
In many cases, it would be a matter of setting up more structured situations so that there's more opportunities to hear and use those languages. You won't be able to count as much on the naturalistic environment to provide enough input for the child to really get up and running with the first language.
Okay, so naturalistic environment could be, for instance, like when I was born. My parents had just arrived to the U.S. a year before that to study. They had tons of international friends, and little Jeannie arrives to two parents who speak Spanish and are surrounded by Spanish-speaking friends. That is a naturalistic environment that, in my case, made it fairly easy to learn Spanish from day one. But when you have a home where there's only one parent who speaks,
it will probably require yet more effort on that parent's part who's bilingual.
Yeah, because I wonder at one point if the child then realizes, okay, mom and dad are speaking in English, why am I bothering with this other language?
Uh-huh. It does happen, I think. But if you persist, you can get there.
And Maria, you know who's making an effort?
Oh, your brother.
My brother.
Oh, my God.
He's making an effort. Well, so, but Bonnie, did you guys sit down and make a conscious decision that you wanted the kids to speak Spanish?
I feel like my inability to communicate with Carlos's extended family is something that I really don't like, and I don't want the kids to have to experience that. And I think that teaching them Spanish from a very young age, it just seemed like any help we could give them would, you know, give them the courage to sort of embrace what is half of their culture and a language that's very essential to it.
That's Bonnie, who is not Latina. They've been married for 10 years and have two beautiful kids, and they're living in South Alabama.
So, Carlos, what happens when they get to an age and they're like, well, papi, you didn't want to speak Spanish growing up, so why do I have to?
You know, it's kind of like eating broccoli. I mean, if I don't eat broccoli, they won't do it either. So there's not really much I can say there. I think at the end of the day, I can make a conscious decision to talk in Spanish to them. And so if they want to communicate with me, they're going to have to understand it.
Whoa.
Very different from Carlos in part one.
Yeah, from Carlos Metallica, I'm going out on my skateboard and don't talk to me about Spanish. Whoa.
Yeah. And Elena's favorite song is actually by Shakira, which is super cute. So as the kids grow, the pediatrician is constantly monitoring their language development. One of the things that Carlos talked to her about was bilingual children.
And the one thing that they said is that the reason why Elena understands me speaking Spanish is because I only speak Spanish to her. The reason why she doesn't talk back to me in Spanish is because I give her the opportunity to speak in English. Apparently, if I want to force Elena to speak in Spanish, I have to pretend I don't understand English. And if she wants to talk to her dad, she's got to talk in Spanish. Between all of the tantrums and everything else that goes on, that's a really hard fight.
I haven't been a parent for that long, but I get that a lot of it is picking your battles. Kind of like, do I want to go there? My kid is throwing a tantrum. Do I really want to make them speak Spanish to me right now?
But that's the thing. Carlos will have to make that decision probably really soon before Elena gets much older. And then it's just going to have to be written in stone.
Exactly.
And he's the one who's going to have to kind of live with that decision.
So I am still curious, what was the light bulb moment for my brother? Like, what changed for him? Why all of a sudden now it's okay to pass on your culture when as a kid he was like,
no, thank you.
What changed really was the fact that when I got older, I mean, you start to think about your heritage and, you know, you start listening to Spanish music on the radio and you start playing this kind of music for your kids and you want to give that heritage to your children. So I kind of just said, you know, I can't just keep being embarrassed and not worrying about it. So I just said, I'm just going to, you know, teach this language to my kids and your world opens up. I mean, now if you can speak Spanish, there's so many countries you can travel to. There's so many books that you can read. There's so many songs that you can sing. You can just experience the world completely different.
I mean, do you recognize that you kind of like pushed it away? Like, why now?
I want my kids to connect to that, at least in some way. And maybe they'll do the same thing as me. I mean, they're growing up in South Alabama. So, I mean, they'll probably just go to a bunch of crawfish boils and get a big truck.
But you can go to a lot of crawfish boils and own a truck and still speak Spanish, right?
You can talk about the truck in Spanish.
Exacto.
I think it's because I have a family now. Before, I think it was just about me, but now when you have a family, it's not about you anymore.
When I think about it, Maria, it's about fear, right? As parents, we're terrified that our children aren't going to speak perfect Spanish. And as the child, you're terrified you're going to be made fun of for not speaking it well. And whether or not your kid learns to speak your native language and learns to speak it with an accent kind of depends on a lot of different factors that are totally out of your control.
Right. I mean, there's just so much to this issue. I mean, you know, whether or not you can get back to your home country, whether or not you have, you know, people who are able to speak Spanish full time at home, whether or not you have people who are able to speak really good English in the same home. So, yeah, it's definitely hard. But Carlos,
I'm proud of him. I mean, he had a lot of fear and a lot of embarrassment growing up, but then he just kind of like had kids and was like, you know what? It's not about me anymore. So I'm going to kick the embarrassment to the curb and I'm going to speak this language because I want them to learn it.
¿Y Martín?
Y Martín, I'm going to keep singing Spanish songs to him, just like my mom sang to me. And I'm going to hope for the best.
I'm para mí la que yo adoré, la que yo adoré.
Oh my gosh. So that's little Martin. And he's singing La Palomita. He's 2 years old now.
Yeah. All day long he sings La Palomita. And he puts the words that he knows to the tune of La Palomita.
But it's all words in Spanish.
All words in Spanish, yeah.
That's interesting. That's what he feels most comfortable with right now.
Yeah.
So how's the Spanish thing going?
It's going.
Diremos, ¿va súper bien?
It's definitely harder than I thought.
Because?
We speak Spanish at home, so that's not hard, but he's regardless getting exposed to two languages, so he's not speaking as fluidly as I see other kids doing at his age. So it's a little bit discouraging.
I mean, is that kind of like your own sense of feeling discouraged or someone telling you you should be worried?
Oh, it's my own mom guilt.
So here's the thing. There is this notion that you get really worried. But really, your son is more brilliant than you can imagine because he's processing two languages at the same time. And
yeah.
So it's kind of like, can you just applaud yourself for doing that and for staying or attempting to stay positive?
Yeah. And I mean, I definitely try to remind myself that I was kind of the product of the same kind of upbringing. And I am speaking to you in full sentences. So I guess I turned out okay.
Well, so speaking of that upbringing, what's the latest with your brother?
Things are going good with him. He has another baby.
Yay!
They're still keeping up the same thing. You know, one parent, one language.
And does he feel good about the decision about making his family fully bilingual? Is he like 100%?
Yeah, he says the kids are listening to books in Spanish now too. So I'd say he's pretty committed.
Okay, Jeannie, so what are the next steps for you and Martin?
He just started a TWS program, which we're adjusting to, but it's a fully bilingual program. So I'm very excited. I think he's going to make a lot more progress now, especially being around other kids.
But it sounds like you're doing the right thing. It's more just like, how do moms who want to teach their kids to be fully bilingual or stronger in Spanish first, how do we do it in a society when all you hear is English? So kudos to you for doing it.
Kudos to you for doing it.
Our thanks to producer Ginny Montalvo for bringing us that story. That's it for today. Latino USA is produced by Miguel Macias, Antonia Cerejido, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoka, and Alisa Escarce, with help from Ginny Montalvo and Maya Cueva. We're edited by Sofia Paliza Carr. Our senior editor is Fernanda Camarena. Our engineers are Stephanie LeBeau and Julia Caruso. Additional engineering this week by Leah Shaw. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholtz. Our digital team includes Julio Ricardo Varela and Amanda Alcantara. Our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow is Fernanda Uriegas. Our interns are Adriana Tapia and Juan Diego Ramirez. Fact-checking this week by Amy Tardif. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. If you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation creates a brighter future for the nation's children by strengthening families, building greater economic opportunity, and transforming communities. New York Women's Foundation. The New York Women's Foundation, funding women leaders that build solutions in their communities and celebrating 30 years of radical generosity. And funding for Latino USA's coverage of A Culture of Health is made possible in part by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
I'm going to turn this off because it's probably not safe for me to drive. And voice memo, goodbye.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Heather Sturt Haga and Paul G. Haga, supporting African Wildlife Foundation, working to ensure the future of Africa's wildlife and wild lands. Learn more at awf.org. And Jane and Gerald Catcher, supporting the Children's Movement of Florida, dedicated to helping all children enter school with the social, emotional, and intellectual skills needed to succeed. More information is available at childrensmovementflorida.org. This is NPR.